This is Andre Traversa. Welcome once again to the Cosmic Citizen Radio Show on Saturday, the first weekend in December. I'm not sure what the date is, but it is the first weekend in December. Anyway, with me, that was Francel Garwin, by the way. If anybody wants to hear her golden voice and buy her CDs, you can go to Francel.com. That's F-R-A-N-C-Y-L, Francel.com. And another person with a lovely voice is, of course, my co-host Paula Thompson. Paula, how are you?
Hi, everyone. I'm great, Andre.
Good.
It's a beautiful morning.
Good. Me too. You know, our show, Paula, is a family show, G-rated. We don't do anything X-rated, don't do anything even PG on this show. It's family. It's a wholesome show. So in continuation of that wholesome family theme, we are continuing with our thread about family issues and children and parents and all that good stuff. Last week we had Buck and Arlene Weimer on the air talking about what mothers and fathers give children. Of course, a couple weeks before that, we had Crystal and Deke on the phone talking about adoption and foster care and all those kinds of things. We had a really great discussion about parenting and fatherhood and things like that. So in continuation of that theme, we are very proud to introduce our guest today, Sarah Blackstock. Sarah Blackstock has been a Urantia Book reader also for a long time, I think for almost 40 years.
35. You know, you lose track after a while.
Okay. She has also been involved in child care of various kinds for 40 years and has a lot to say about children. I remember seeing Sarah for the first time in 1990 at an international conference in Snowmass in Colorado, and the workshop was called Seeing Spiritual Qualities in Kids, and that's some of what we're going to be discussing today. Sarah, welcome again to the Cosmic Citizen Radio Show.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you. Actually, you're here for the first time. I said again. I shouldn't have said, but anyway. Sarah, let me ask you something. As I think back to that workshop that I attended, and I think back on your presentation, I mean, it was a while ago, but, you know, Jesus tells us that, you know, we need to become like little children to enter the kingdom of God. Why do you think Jesus said that? What is it about children that made Jesus say that? What is it about children what qualities do children have that we could cultivate as God's children, you know, that helps us to enter the kingdom of God?
Jesus was talking about the child-father relationship when he was talking about becoming as a little child in the kingdom. Actually, he said that several times. But the child-father relationship has to do with trusting the father and the parents, the natural affection that every normal child has for his or her father, and that loving relationship. And then another time he said that when you enter into the kingdom, you must make progress and you must humble yourself as a child. And, there are some children that I would not consider very humble, but most of the time children have that beautiful humbleness, and that humbleness allows them to be teachable. So if that's one of the qualities of children is to be teachable, which it definitely is, then that's a really important aspect for us to look at, is becoming teachable, because God, the thought adjuster, the angels, our friends, the universe wants to teach us about the love of God.
You know,
so that's part of it.
One of the things that you were talking, I mean, it's kind of, this next question may sound a little off the subject or off the, can't resist asking, it just came to mind, Sarah. What has kept you in the child care field for as long as you've been? I mean, why are you still sticking with that career?
Well, children, I work with children the ages of about 5 through 12 years old, so I don't work with those little kids. These kids are a little bit bigger than that. And I've been a teacher. I'm a credentialed teacher, and I'm the executive director of a large school-age daycare center. And I am in it because it is so fascinating to see children progress and grow. When the children first come to us, at least in the school-age daycare center, they're 4 years, 9 months. Most of them probably do not have their thought adjusters at that time. And then over the next year or maybe year and a half, I know that the thought adjuster has come to the child, and even though I can't, necessarily see a moment or a period of time that delineates this, I can become aware that the child has become more altruistic, more compassionate, more interested in other people. And I say to myself, yes, this looks like, you know, maybe the thought adjuster has come. So that period is interesting to me. And then it is also these ages in particular that I think the habits of a lifetime are established in these ages. When they enter in puberty or even pre-puberty at, maybe 11 or 12 now, earlier every year, sometimes 10, unfortunately, they get into the hormonal thing and life becomes much more complex for them. But the simplicity of the young child is very exciting because they're growing. Their brain growth spurts are very rapidly developing. And, you know, I could go on and on, but, you know.
So you get to witness that, and what an,
yes,
what an honor and what a privilege that is. And you've shared over the years that I've known you, and I attended that workshop in 90 that Andre mentioned, recognizing the spirituality in children, and I was very, very interested in it myself because as a child I was deeply spiritual, and I noticed that adults didn't recognize it. And in fact, I've shared the story that I was kicked out of the church at 10 for the terrible crime of wanting to sit and hear the pastor speak. I did not want to go to Sunday school. I wanted to hear the minister speak. And they forced me to leave, and I never went back. And so I was very interested in that topic of recognizing the spirituality in children. And over the years, Sarah, you've shared so many touching stories. You shared a story with us all at the conference last summer, Joy in the Worm Bin, where you talked about all the metaphors that you and the children learned from reviving these comatose worms. Which was just priceless. I treasure that, and I'm wondering, can you share with us what you value the most in terms of what is something about children that you just cherish the most, or a story that has just touched your heart so deeply? I know there's so many, and you've shared a lot over the years, but just something that is invaluable and precious insight into children.
Well, you know, it's what's interesting to me is that often when people think of spirituality in children, they think of, maybe a child open, giving, loving, compassionate, that, you know, the wonderful qualities that we might normally think of. And those I see in the children, but the qualities of spirituality in children that really interest me are the qualities that would have to do more with their sense of adventure, their courage, their willingness to go into new worlds, their openness to all aspects of spirituality. In nature, and so you know, you can picture the sweet child sitting and listening, like you were probably listening to a sermon. Or another image is a child running around in nature, just feeling absolutely glorious in the awesomeness of nature. And I love to take children. One of my favorite field trips is to take 40 or 50 children to the ocean. And the spirituality that I see there is such an engagement with life, with nature. And the Urantia book tells us that nature is the habit of God. And so I think that taking children into nature, challenging them perhaps to, you know, climb a big hill, to sit and listen to the ocean. One of my favorite experiences every summer is to take this group of 40 or 50 kids to the ocean, and they play and run, and, you know, we climb the hills and all of that. And then when the sun is going down at the end of the day, they all have drums or tambourines or finger cymbals, and we line ourselves up on a great big sand area facing the ocean with the waves crashing, and the sun is setting, and they start beating the drums and cleaning their little finger cymbals and watching the sun go down. And then we have a moment of silence as we say thank you to the universe. And that, to me, is just a moment of profound witness to the deep spirituality. That moment lasts just a little while. I mean, just a very short time.
Yes.
Yeah. And then they have to really pound the drums.
Wow. See, now I know that you've written a book called Kindle Their Fire, and that my heart swelled as you described that experience just there, because I was there with you on the beach with those children. How to honor, you've described in many ways over the years how to honor their spirituality and how to, ignite it and accept it and reveal it and allow them to express it. And that's just really beautiful. That was a great visual image I got there from seeing. I saw those children with you on the beach watching the sun go down with their cymbals and their drums and their moment of silence. And I have found myself that children are very reverent. They can be naturally reverent. I remember myself going into the mountains with my grandmother and my father, and the minute we'd lay out the blanket and set down our picnic, and then we'd all get very, very reverent because we just felt so close to God. And I know the Urantia book says that nature is a very good place to take children to.
Yes, and in fact, Jesus, tells us to take children into the tabernacles of nature. And I think he even desires that before we take them into the basements of the churches sometimes. Children should be in places of beauty. And, there are some churches that are really quite beautiful. But unfortunately, often the children leave the beauty of the sanctuary and they're taken down into a basement. And I think that, I'm not sure that that's so conducive as, well, let's just walk out and sit underneath a tree and watch the leaves fall or listen to the call of the birds. I think that children need to be honored in the aspect of religiosity that is normally in them. The other thing that I think is very interesting about honoring different ways that children find God and experience spirituality is in the realm of the educational sciences. Howard Gardner, did research and devised a system called multiple intelligences. And he came up with 8 different kinds of intelligences that we all have in us, but children might have 1 or 2 of these, which is stronger. And I won't go into it. It's a whole system. But an example is the verbal linguistic, the child that loves to read, write, tell stories, hear stories. Now, those might be a child like you who wanted to sit and listen to the sermons. Then there are the children that have a bodily kinesthetic intelligence. These are the ones that like to dance, act. They're the more athletic ones. They're the ones that could not sit and listen to a sermon. They are the ones that would be, with a drum dancing and experiencing, the spirituality that way. There's a musical intelligence. These are the ones that through rhythm, through music, they are always singing or humming and wanting to listen to music, wanting to be in music, and perhaps that would be their avenue to spirituality. I think we see that a lot with young people these days.
Sarah, I want to ask you 2 questions. The first one is a practical question.
Okay, hey, Andre, before you go on, we have a couple callers.
Oh, great, great, okay.
So do you want me to take a caller?
Yeah, let's take the call.
And
I guess people already know our numbers, but let me just say them on the air for those who don't, for whatever reason. Our number, if you want to call in to talk to Sarah Blackstock, is 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. And we always give preference to our callers, so I will delay the questions until later. So
okay, save that thought, Andre. 516, you're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen. Hello? 516.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Tavine. I'm calling from New York.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. I am also a Urantia member. And
great.
I'm very impressed with your show today. Keep up the good work. God bless you.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. And happy holidays.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did you have a question for Sarah?
Not really. I just wanted to encourage you.
Oh, thanks.
Well, thank you. We certainly could need more of that. So I'm never going to turn encouragement down.
Yes, yes. God bless you.
God bless you, too.
Happy holidays. Thank you, darling. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. We got another one, too, Andre. Hold on. Sometimes there's a delay in the time it takes to answer the call. Okay, here we go. Whoops. 443, you're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen.
Hello, Paula. This is George in Maryland.
Hi, George. How are
you? I'm here with a little guy, so it's full of us.
You're right in the throes of this wonderful child discovery thing, huh?
Yes, I hope to contribute a little later. I'm going to soak up some information first.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
I guess George just wants to listen for a while, Andre.
Right.
So go.
Okay.
What age of children does George have?
He has a brand new baby.
Oh, wonderful. Just beginning. George, George, can I just give you one little suggestion that I think is so powerful that I always give parents of newborns?
Okay.
Light a candle every once in a while where that child can see the candle. And in the child's presence, to say, thank you, God, for the light in us. Children love fire.
Okay.
And that fire will rivet even a newborn's attention.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Let me ask you two questions, Sarah. The first question I have is a practical question, and that is, it's out of curiosity. You work at a, correct me if I'm wrong, you work at a daycare. If that's the case, these kids are from ages 5 to 12. Are these kids coming there after school? Is that the idea?
They are there from 7 in the morning, and then they go to school, and we have a junior kindergarten program preparing kids for kindergarten. And then the afternoon kindergartners are there, and then they go to school, and morning kindergartners, and then children first, second, third, and fourth, fifth grades come after school from 2:30, and many of them stay until 6 o'clock.
Okay.
The parents have to drag them out.
Okay, I gotcha. Oh, hey. Well, let me ask you another question, and that is, one of the things you talked about nature and how important that is, and I think that's great, but one thing that I also would like to talk about, and I mentioned this on the show once in passing, but I'd love to get your read on this, a lot of fundamentalist Christians are very upset and hysterical over this Harry Potter craze. You know, they think Harry Potter is evil and all the rest of this stuff. And I don't know about you, but one of the things you were talking about is how spirituality can be captured in a child's sense of wonder. Wonder at the universe, wonder.
Yes.
And I don't know about you, but don't you think that fantasy is good for kids? Don't you think it's good for their imagination? I think that not only am I not upset by things like Harry Potter, I think it's great that kids are into Harry Potter. First of all, the reading instead of watching TV. But the other thing that I think is great about it is, to me, the thing I think is so great about fantasy, whether it's Harry Potter or the C.S. Lewis stories, the Chronicles of Narnia, whatever it is it gets kids to start thinking about a world beyond this world. And I think that's what makes it so valuable. And to me, I mean, I just think that, to me, what a doorway, what an incredible doorway to start talking about spiritual things with kids. What's your take on fantasy?
Oh, I totally agree with you. In fact, I would see, you know how big those Harry Potter books are? I would see kids at the daycare carrying these books around and hiding in a corner just to read how many of them were, whether there were four or five of them. And as I talked to the kids about what is it that you found so interesting, and one of the things, the main issue is the archetypal fight between good and evil.
Oh, yes.
And what you're dealing with in fairy tales, in myths, in Harry Potter, in all of the mysticism, is an archetypal relationship that the child has to have with good and evil, kings and queens, battles, heroes, courage. The child has to experience that. And some children can experience it in drama. But at the very early age, in fairy tales, in fact, Bruno Bettelheim, one of the, you know, the greats of the child development, said that fairy tales are a must for children, at least up to the ages of 4, 5, and 6, because it helps the child engage with their world in some of the real big questions of life, like death, you know, mommy dying. You know, many fairy tales have the mother dying and the child alone. Children are orphans, and where do they go? And so through these fairy tales, these big worries about that children have are resolved. And even in you know, Little Red Riding Hood, the adventure that children experience as they you know, go along with Little Red Riding Hood as she goes to visit her grandmother and the big wolf. And actually, in the real story, the wolf eats the grandmother, and that's it. But they've toned down some of these fairy tales, which I think is unfortunate, because children are not bothered by the wolf eating the grandmother. You know, that's a resolution to it. But adults,
you know,
are very
Sarah,
bothered.
I always remember you telling a story, and just has always stayed with me. And I know you've probably over the years seen parents make a lot of mistakes. I know you've had close associations with parents and children, and that's the thing that people don't think, you know, about. But anybody who teaches or who is in the position you're in has close association with not only the children but with the parents,
yes,
and with the family dynamic. And you shared a story with me once about a little boy who, you know, was so addicted to Nintendo.
Oh, yeah.
and game
yeah,
electronics. And he came to the daycare, and he was actually going through physical withdrawals. I don't think
mm-hmm.
parents realize sometimes how detrimental this constant, you know, being sucked into the cyber world can be. And you said that, you know, after a couple of days, big crocodile tears just pouring down his
mm-hmm.
face, and you asked him, are you addicted to Nintendo? And he just nodded his head, yes,
mm-hmm.
big tears
mm-hmm.
pouring down his face. And you went and got some of the older children and said, hey, he needs to get involved with your game of Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at the time, Dungeons and Dragons was getting some really bad press.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And you really opened my eyes and said, no, it's just the most wonderful game. The kids take on roles, they interact, they'll play it for hours, and it stimulates their imagination. And
yes,
I always think of that. You know, I always remember that, Sarah, because that's such a great lesson to, you know, I think oftentimes probably the biggest mistake a parent can make is to want to just put their child somewhere where they aren't bothered by them, you know. So they use the TV as a babysitter, or the games, or the whatever, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, you know, I deal with this all the time
because
children. In fact, we got to the point in our daycare center where we do not allow any of these little video games, and not video games, but these things they carry around, DSLs, you know, like DSS or something like that. They carry them around in their hands, and they plug themselves in. And we don't allow that. We do have computers, and the computers have some, you know, really adventuresome, fun games on it. And they have to set their timers for 30 minutes. And we
right.
find children sneaking, you know, to get more and more and more. And when I see one of these addicts, I'll put them on cold turkey because they cannot stay away from the computer. And I realized that, you know, here's other kids over there building blocks, or here's kids, and we have a sandbox that's almost half a block long. And I know what healthy children can do. The problem that I understand through research with too much screens, that's, you know, the TV, the video games, these little handheld things, is that they change the brain waves in the child's brain, because they move so fast, you know, the images move so fast. And so the child gets addicted to that kind of stimulation from the fast movement. And anything else is slower than that.
Yes,
so the child
true.
Feels bored, and the child cannot feel that they are being stimulated enough when they're just sitting and building blocks. I've seen 10, 11, 12-year-old children building blocks.
Right.
And those are the children that have a better balance. I don't think you should, you know, not allow children to, you know, play some of these things and use them. That, you know, they're part of our world, but you can be there as a parent and teacher to help them do so with time limits, okay,
right.
You know, 30 minutes, even
yeah.
though some of the researchers recommend that children under the age of 5 don't be exposed to any screens at all.
Yeah, I actually tend to agree with that. Let me ask you, Sarah, I have a really controversial question for you. And for those, so you don't know me, this is the first time you've been on the air with me, you don't know that people, my last name is Traversa. People call me Andre Controversa. So I'm going to put you on the spot here
uh-huh.
and ask you a question. I was going to ask you this off the record, but I'm going to ask you on the air, okay? And I'm just going to ask you, and just be, I'd love to get your honest feedback on this. You know, we talked about parents, you know, using TV as a babysitter or,
mm-hmm.
you know, those kinds of things, some of the mistakes parents make. What do you think of some of the criticisms that people have made of daycare? You know, I've heard
mm-hmm.
people say, you know, look, I mean, your parents, you shove the kid off to daycare. You're working, you know, you're working too much. So you can have two incomes to support your extravagant lifestyle. You know, I mean, with a single mom thing, I can understand. But you know, there are people, you know, that you say, you know, your kids are not being bonded to you. They're more bonded with the daycare providers than they are with you. You know. You're just, I mean, there's so many different criticisms that have been made of daycare. What's your take on some of that?
Well, the research shows that children who have been in an excellent daycare, okay, this is not one that sits kids down in front of the TV set. This is one where there's a lot of activities provided and the teachers are interacting with the children. And the children have a wide exposure. The research shows that children who are in a daycare like that have advantages over children who go home after school where they're just as likely to watch TV.
Very true.
In, you know, with a parent there because they learn conflict resolution skills. They learn team building skills. They learn to share with many, many children rather than perhaps go home to sharing with just a couple of siblings. They are exposed to a wide variety of problems, and they see how these problems are worked out. The research shows that these children develop skills beyond the skills that would be given in a kind of an average home. Now, if you have somebody that is homeschooling their child and you know, is actually providing these kinds of experiences for the children, then, you know, it's probably a really good thing.
Yes, which I'm going to make a plug for homeschooling because I'm all for it.
Yes, yes.
But let me ask you this. I'm going to play devil's advocate with you again just for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Someone people say, well, aren't kids learning these things in school? Why do they have to, why should they be spending even more time away from home?
Unfortunately, with the teaching to the test that's happening today.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, the schools are so busy teaching to the test, they actually do not deal very much with emotional intelligence
mm-hmm.
or social intelligence. They are dealing just pretty much with the brain, you know, having the brain take in facts. Now, a good teacher will always bypass that. A good teacher will always be sure that there's conflict resolution going on in the classroom when there's problems, and there's always problems. A good teacher will be sure that children are learning how to become more emotionally self-controlled. A good teacher will be sure that children have plenty of social interaction. But too often, the classroom is you sit here and, do this paperwork or listen to me. And all of these other realms that need to be developed with the child are not being developed. Because if the teacher doesn't show that her classroom can, you know, do good work on these tests, then she's in trouble. But once again, it has to do with quality and confidence.
You know, right now, I have a little grandson. He's made a special appearance on the show a couple of times.
Oh my, wonderful!
Because he's been here, and of course he's just absolutely beautiful. I have two grandchildren and three children, and my granddaughter is very you know, sweet and mellow and subdued. It's kind of the classic archetypes of boy and girl. And my grandson is very lively and, oh, you know, you were talking about linguistic intelligence, and he loves to sing and he tells stories. He tells stories constantly. He's so animated. He's so dramatic. And I don't know where he gets that from, Sarah. But
oh, I wonder, Paula.
Yeah. But he's been home with Mom for 3.5 years.
How old is he now?
Worked, he's 3.5.
Oh, 3.5.
And
okay.
She's worked part-time.
Mm-hmm.
But she's worked at night, and Dad has worked during the days. And now we have this opportunity for her to, she's got a promotion. She'll be gone 2 whole days. And but the nice thing about it is everybody will be home. The whole family will be together every night.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And she has a lot of concerns about putting Andy, that's his name, Andy, in daycare. And, you know, I really encouraged her because I think at 3.5 and knowing Andy the way I do, I think it'll be good for him.
Yes. And I would agree. I think it's very important that she go visit the daycare, that she go with a list of 15 or 20 things to look for in a daycare and evaluate the daycare or compare 2 or 3 daycares. But once again, the research shows that in an excellent daycare, the children are given skills that they normally would not be able to develop in the home.
Okay, but we're talking about a kid who's 3.5 years old. Does he need a daycare or does he need a nursery school?
You know, they don't use the word nursery school anymore. The words are preschool. So preschool is the same as daycare. You know, it just whether it's a daycare or a preschool or a junior kindergarten program, there should be teaching going on that comes from the director. There should be activities. There should be lots of loving hugs. There should be good nourishing food.
Mm-hmm.
There should be help with problems. There should be organization. It doesn't really matter what it's called. The same kinds of activities should go on. Just because it's daycare, people used to think, well, but, you know, kids go to daycare and they just play. Well, it's through just playing that children are learning to work out their world. So if they're just playing, somebody dying, and I've actually seen that. I've seen children playing. Well, you die. Okay, you're the one that dies now. So the child lies there dead, and the other children cover him up, him or her up, and then they'll have a little ceremony. And so, you know, because somebody just recently died in that child's family.
Yeah, I think that's really important you're making this point, because one of the things, I'm sure you're familiar with the great child psychologist Jean Piaget, who said,
yes,
you know,
yes,
that when children play, he said, play is learning and learning is play. And
yes,
a lot of people don't realize that when children play, they're learning so much that there's such a this sort of instinctive level that my kid needs more structured learning time and more, you know. And I'm not saying everything should be completely unstructured, but my point is that there is a lot that's going on during unstructured playtime that adults may not be aware of. They think it's frivolous or silly, and it's really not. But there's one thing I want to ask you about. You talked about conflict resolution. And I'm going to say something. You may disagree with me on this a little bit, but I don't know. I think there's a balance here, too. I think it's really great to have kids work out their problems, help kids solve their problems, okay, and teach kids conflict resolution skills. I think that's absolutely wonderful. Here's what concerns me. We hear a lot today about bullies and bullying,
mm-hmm,
okay? And you know, this is where maybe I'm a little old-fashioned, but I think if a child is being bullied, I think this is one of those times when adults really do need to intervene and rescue that child. I don't agree with people who say, well, the kid's got to learn to defend themselves, and they've got to, you know.
No.
And you know, this is, I don't think children should have to be forced to deal with that. Now, and also, I'm assuming when you work with conflict resolution, that you don't just leave the kids to fend for themselves, that you help facilitate that.
Absolutely. So what we do with the problems, and there are the bullies, and the bullies seek the victims. I mean, they just, for some reason, are automatically drawn together. And so you have to work with both of them. You have to work with both the bullies and the victims, even at a young age, like the age kids I work with. So if a kid has a problem, say somebody spit at him, and the kid comes to a teacher, we never use the term tattletale, never. You go to a teacher and ask for help. If you use the term tattletale, you're putting the kids on their own because none of them want to be tattletales. So you go to a teacher and ask for help. And you bring the kid with you that spit on you. So both of them come to a teacher.
What if the kid doesn't want to come?
Well, then the kid comes who got spat on, goes to the teacher and says, so-and-so spit on me. And then the teacher goes and finds the child.
Okay,
so you get both kids together, however you do it. And the teacher's job is to be a mediator and a moderator. And so the teacher will say, well, you know, what happened and why did you spit and blah, blah, blah. And so you help the children talk about the problem looking at each other's eyes. And then you want to not have a blame-shame kind of situation. You want to say, well, I see that there was a misunderstanding, so next time what can you do? And so that's kind of the process that we follow. Now, if there is repeat behavior, and I was just dealing with this just the other day, of a child actually bullying a child who was doing very well and taking on the victim role, then I talk with the parents, and I try to help the parent understand what is going on. Both parents understand what's going on. And so the child that was being the victim, I said to the child, if somebody's doing something that you don't like, what do you say? And so the child looks down at the floor and in a very quiet voice says, I don't like that. I said, no, let me show you how you do it. And you look at the child's eyes and the child says, no, I don't like that. Stop it. So you teach a child to have power in a situation.
To stand up for themselves.
That's right, to stand up for themselves. But the father of the child of the victim was actually saying to his child, when somebody bullies you, you should get your fists up.
Oh.
And I had to say to that father, that's old thinking, sir.
Yeah.
You cannot do that these days. Children have to develop the power within themselves. And the children that have that power to look at somebody else and say, I don't like it, stop it, are the ones that will be powerful, not the ones that use their fists.
Yeah, and you have to teach them those skills. We have a caller. Hold on. 562, you're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen. Hello? 562? Hello?
I wonder if that's Norm.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe it is Norm. Okay, sorry about that, you guys. Yeah, Sarah, I just think that is, invaluable to learn how to stand up for yourself in a strong, assertive way, but not a violent way.
Right,
because
right.
Certainly violence is just going to erupt into more violence.
That's right. And Andre's right. Children need help with this. This is not, even though Jesus did say that children are naturally peacemakers, and they are if they are given the skills to be peacemakers, and the skills have to do with using your words. And it also, the children that have a strong ego strength are not the ones that end up to be the bullies or the victims, actually, because they have that strength in them themselves. And, of course, that comes from the parents, that being loved and being given the nourishment that you need. So, the conflict resolution is they definitely need help with that. And the schools are very concerned about bullies now.
And they should be.
They should be, yeah. And the school will get on it. And we just have zero tolerance for teasing, putting down. In fact, I, as the executive director, hear about a child who is teasing. It's such a serious thing. And, they used to say, oh, it's just joking. No, you're not just joking when you put somebody down for not catching a ball the way that you would catch the ball. That's putting the kid down.
And, I have to point something out here because from my own life experience, we grew up with old adages like sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never harm me. That is bunk.
It is bunk.
Words can cut you wider and deeper than sticks and stones ever can. In fact, you get a lot of physical hurts in life, you heal. But some of the mean things that some little schoolyard bully said to you, you never, ever forget. And I remember when my daughter was in fourth and fifth grade, a couple of girls who were the alpha girls in the class singled her out and started harassing her. And it was real legitimate harassment. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they would call her at home to harass her. This poor child had nowhere to go to escape them.
Mm.
And when I called the principal's comment was, oh, it's just, you know, girls have a pecking
mm-hmm.
order.
Yeah. No, they're not taking that attitude anymore.
No, and that's a good thing. Because,
yes.
you know, she'll still talk. She's 34 years old. And she will still talk about Shala and Lori and how they bullied her.
Yeah, yeah. It can be devastating. Yeah.
It still hurts her. You know,
and
so,
Jesus, what, you know what Jesus said? He said children can easily be taught to function as peacemakers. So it's not necessarily something that comes naturally. It might come naturally for some children. But the other day I was solving a problem out on the playground, and a kid had thrown a bottle at a wounded goose. And I was, you know, trying to get the kid to, you know, tell me why that was not a good idea. And here comes another kid who's a couple years older, and he just comes right up and begins to help me with this younger child solve the problem in the sense of, why shouldn't you do that?
Right.
And he was asking the right question. So here's a fifth grader that was taught conflict resolution coming right up and interfacing with this second grader who had thrown the bottle at the goose. And I backed away.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I said, this guy is on it. And he just took over.
How gratifying is that? You know, Mae has beautiful. Taken my 13-year-old, Mae just turned 13.
Oh, yeah.
She's taken those conflict resolution classes, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, as a junior high kid, she's on the peace committee.
Beautiful.
And yeah, and I'm thrilled.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled that they have these things now. It's almost like they're embracing the reality that, hey, maybe, you know, the way we've done it before wasn't the right way to do it, and maybe we could do it better. And, you know, as
yes.
sad as what happened at Columbine was,
yes.
I really
yes.
think that that changed things, and so that's the bright, that's the, you know, the silver lining in that very dark cloud there.
Yes, yes. I don't think there's anything almost that is more important to teach children these days as they go into the world than to be peacemakers. And, you know, they have so much help. You know, as we know, when they're between the ages of 5 and 6, the thought adjuster, that light of God, comes to dwell within them and will stay with them for the rest of their life. And not only that they have the spirit of truth, that the spirit that Jesus left. They have the 7 adjutant spirits now, the circuits that hook in of, you know, intuition, knowledge, courage, counsel, understanding, and then the last 2, worship and wisdom. They have all of these influences which will help them with their moral development, with their spiritual development. And I think the important thing is the difference to me between spiritual parenting and just parenting is realizing that you have so much help in the universe if you will just provide a foundation for your child to be able to actualize, allow these forces, these circuits, this light of God to be actualized. And, you know, if we don't provide that foundation, if we don't light the candles, if we don't have the little ceremonies, then it doesn't reinforce the marvelous gifts that have been given to each and every child. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about the Urantia book for me, is learning what happens between the ages of 5 and 6 when a child makes their first moral decision.
Wow. Well, you know, and I want to talk to you about spiritual parenting as well, because I know that's one of the things you wanted to discuss, Sarah. But before we do that, I want to get on a soapbox here again a little bit, because one of the things that I totally am on board with you about conflict resolution and all these other things. And you mentioned something that I wanted to piggyback on a little bit, and that is you mentioned that you have zero tolerance for put-downs and bullying and that kind of thing. One thing that concerns me, though, is I wish we could find a balance between what people, how kids were raised in the old days and how we're raising kids now, because I think that we may be going too far in the direction of overprotection in some situations.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy I wish we could get on the air. His name is Paul Donahue. He's got a book out called Parenting Without Fear, and I wanted to get him on the air, but he doesn't want to do it. He's a psychologist. But, you know, one thing, you mentioned zero tolerance. I'll just give you an example. one thing that really concerns me a lot about a lot of public schools is they have zero tolerance policies, but it's because they are because we live in such a litigious society that they're so risk averse. They don't want. I mean, for example, they don't let kids bring nail clippers to school, you know, because they're afraid it's a weapon. You know, could be used as a weapon. You can poke a kid's eye out with a pencil. You know, what are you going to do? Ban pencils? You know.
Yeah.
The other thing that you're having happen is, I mean, this just scares me to death, Sarah. I mean, we have. I mean, don't get me wrong. I am very, very glad that we have awareness about sexual abuse today. I'm very glad. But what's happening now is we're taking that awareness to the point where we are punishing children for the wrong things. I mean, I kid you not. I'm hearing of these cases about little children, 4-year-old children, who are being accused of sexual harassment. There was a kid, a little boy in Texas, who buried his face in a teacher's aide's breast because he was 4 years old, and he gave her a hug and he buried his face in her breast. You know, and apparently the teacher, I don't know if it was a teacher's aide or someone who observed the situation, accused this little 4-year-old boy of sexual harassment. There was a case, a 6-year-old boy, who smacked a little girl on the butt. I guess he was just kidding around with her, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, he also was accused. He actually called the police. I mean, what is going on here today? I mean, this really does concern me, some of these overreactions.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It is an overreaction. And I think that it's one of the effects of mediaization.
Mm-hmm.
Parents go home, turn on the TV set. You know, one incident might happen, and that incident is reported over and over and over. And you think that this is going on all over. Well, it's not. You know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of schools and daycares that are operating in a more normal way. However, one really has to think about it. In fact, at a staff meeting yesterday, I was just talking about our sexual abuse and molestation policy. In order to get insurance, we have to assure our insurance agent that there will always be 3 people present. That means that you cannot have a teacher and a child alone.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can have 2 kids and a teacher. So,
right.
You know, those things are facts of life. So, you know, but the overreaction, I think, is actually detrimental. And we have almost half of our staff is male teachers. And I love having men working with children. It's dangerous, though. Because, you know, a woman can sit a child on her lap and nobody would think anything about
right.
it. But a man sits a child on his lap and it's like, uh-oh. So we train our male children. Here, whatever you're doing, you have to be sure that a father or a mother can look at what you're doing and feel good about it.
But it's funny you mentioned, I want to point out, you mentioned hugs a few minutes ago.
Uh-huh.
I think it's really that this is where I think the overreaction is happening. What really concerns, I actually remember even as early as 1988 when I was in high school, I was told by a teacher that they got a memo from the principal saying, well, you're not supposed to touch students because of sexual abuse. I mean, that really concerns me that because children need, well, we all need love and affection, but, you know, children, my God, in particular, I mean, you know, that really does concern me the other thing that happened that's really crazy, though, is, you know, you got these kids being accused. I remember there was one child in second grade in North Carolina who was accused of sexual harassment for kissing a little girl on the cheek.
Oh,
what is that? What message are we sending children when we tell them that? What do you say? It's wrong for you to show affection to other people? I mean, you know, and the kid was suspended. He couldn't go to the ice cream party. He was ostracized.
Well,
and
you know,
unbelievable.
The pendulum always has to swing both ways, and I think that's the difficult thing about living in the world, and especially in a world in an age of mass communication. It's just what Sarah said. You know, we tend to overreact because the pendulum swings both ways, and and we hear these isolated incidents. You know, we think that they're happening frequently. They really aren't. They're isolated, but because of the media coverage of them, then all of a sudden they're in everybody's mind, and that's unfortunate. It can be a good and a bad thing. You guys want to take a couple of calls?
Absolutely.
Sarah, the boards are lighting up, my dear. Here, hold on.
You see what happens when I get controversial? There we go.
Oh, yeah. It's all you, Andre. It's all your controversy. 720, you're on Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, Paula. This is Pam.
Hi, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It was earlier you guys were talking about it, but, you know, I wasn't, when I was raised, I didn't have too much communication with my parents. It was like kids should be seen and not heard.
Right.
That was the kind of thing I heard all the time. And so when I was 12 or 10 or I can't remember exactly what age I was, but I had seen this movie, Breakfast at Tiffany's, where Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard were in this little dime store, and they had little masks, Halloween masks on, and it, to me, in my child brain, it looked like they were trying to steal something. So I went to the dime store by myself, and so I wasn't looking at the object that I was going to steal because I thought it was so cool. And what I picked up was a picture of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I put the picture down immediately, and it was like Jesus was the one that was teaching
mm-hmm.
me and not my parents. You know, I mean, they always said, I mean, you never steal or anything like that. But he was the one that came to me and intervened. I always felt that he was there watching me. And so sometimes I think that that does happen. That's all I wanted to say.
Yes. Children are naturally an undamaged child, let's say, are naturally conscious of right and wrong. And they have choices to make. But I, too, believe that Jesus is always with us, always with our children. And, if it, you know, sometimes, I handle the stealers and the liars and the cheaters, you know. Little kids actually do those things. Mm-hmm. And they come to my office and we talk about it. And we talk about, did you really want to do this? Did you really want to take that child's, you know, cookie? How do you feel about that? And they always feel bad about it. Their conscience, you know, does not allow them to feel good about stealing. And I can't talk, obviously, about Jesus because we're in a public situation, so I have to be very careful. We have a lot of Jewish people. But I can talk about being powerful and that there are forces that will help you be powerful, that the universe wants you to be powerful. And if you ever have a question about what you should do, you can ask. But I personally believe that Jesus is right there with our children.
I think so, too.
Yes.
Well, I think
and children are very sensitive. I mean, I experienced that as a child. I've been in love with Jesus all my life. And my first experience of the Spirit of Truth was when I was quite young. And I felt the reality of Jesus. I knew he was real. And it was all based on a, you know, my mom used to sing Away in a Manger to me because I had a hard time sleeping as a small child. And I pondered, you know, she'd sing that that carol as a lullaby, and I pondered that, and I was pondering the reality of Jesus being a baby, and I felt the Spirit of Truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first experience of Jesus. I'll never forget it. And it started a lifelong desire to know him and to find that warmth in others. I loved my minister, the one I wanted to hear speak. I loved him because he radiated warmth and love like I imagined
mm-hmm.
Jesus did.
Mm.
You know?
What a role model.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it just broke my heart when they wouldn't let me hear him speak. I mean, it just, because that's
And you know what? That's
reason.
The exact opposite, Paula, what Jesus would have done, because Jesus said, no, don't, you know, let the children come to me.
Suffer them to come to me. Let them come. Yeah,
yeah.
Sure. You know, so...
So I think it's important, thank you. I think it's important for parents to be sure that their children have the heroes. If you're a Muslim, in the Muslim books, the Quran, I'm sure that there's some heroes. Of course, Muhammad, the Jewish books, the Old Testament, Moses and Abraham. There's great children's stories that have been written about these heroes. And Jesus. You know, the children do resonate with Jesus for the Christian families,
mm-hmm.
and it's important to make these stories real to the children, and because the Spirit of Jesus is encircuited in them,
right?
And Angela tells
real.
Us that the Spirit of Truth encircuits itself in the child when they make that first moral decision. So the Spirit of Truth is Jesus. It's the Spirit of Jesus. And whether
That's
one
very
says,
important.
Yeah, whether one says Jesus, 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 that doesn't necessarily matter. You know, all of the qualities of Jesus, the love of Jesus, the courage of Jesus, the adventuresomeness of Jesus, all of those qualities of Jesus, I believe, are part of the Spirit of Truth
Absolutely.
Encircuiting our children.
And we're all capable of feeling those values and honoring those values. And really what it's about ultimately is helping children see those values,
yes.
see what really matters, what really matters? Is it the things that matter? Or is it relationship? Is it love? Is it honor? Is it respect? Is it trustworthiness? Is it, you know, mercy, kindness? And children are more than capable of valuing what really matters. In fact, I think they naturally value those things. You just have to hold them up for them. And
I think
and,
so, too. And, you know, there's just some recent research that, or a study, actually, that came out. The topic of the study was children are born believers in God.
Yeah.
Academic claims. You saw that, I think.
Yeah, that article went around.
Yeah, Dr. Justin Barrett, a senior researcher at the University of Oxford's Center for Anthropology and Mind, now there's a title for you, claims that young people have a predisposition to believe in a supreme being because they assume that everything in the world was created with a purpose. And so I didn't, you know, I haven't read the actual research, but one example was given in one of the studies. 6 and 7 year olds were asked why the first bird existed. And the children said, to make nice music, and because it makes the world look nice. And so children have this natural predisposition to assume the goodness of the world and the goodness of life. And here we have, you know, some studies now that are coming forth and showing this.
Well, and on that note, we have another caller. Hold on.
Okay.
Hello, 303, you're on Blog Talk.
Hi, are you talking to me?
Yeah, hi, darling.
How are you?
I knew it was you, but I didn't want to blow your cover. It's Crystal and Beak, you guys.
Hey, Crystal.
Hi. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Well, I just love your topic today. I also, this is an off the subject comment, but I can never get on the blog, by the way. And I'm listening, and it occurred to me that that might be something you could review with people, maybe.
You know, I'm glad you brought it up. Norman Ingram is having a hard time getting on the blog, and he just got on it. And I know that you have to register with Blog Talk. You actually have to set up an account, which is free, and then you should be able
to
do it.
But I've registered like 4 times now, and I have yet to be able to succeed, so...
Okay, well, we'll
maybe
give that one to Larry.
Maybe it's just me, but maybe I'm not the most technically astute. But I just wanted to say that I love the topic today. And I was calling to share a personal experience because I grew up outside of the U.S., as many of you know. I grew up in West Africa. And I had the benefit of going to an international school from a very early age. And we had such a different culture than what I experienced when I moved to the U.S. and interfaced with schools here. And it was really a shock to the system for me because my experience here was that kids were just unbelievably horrible and rude and mean, and that was part of sort of the culture here. And I know this will probably offend some listeners, but I want to say that even though my peer group were Americans, we were American missionary kids living overseas, we thought of ourselves as Americans, but we had lived most of our lives overseas. And when we were going to this international school, we may have noticed sort of through our peripheral vision that the kids who had the hardest time integrating into this international diversity system that really respected diversity way before it was sort of the politically correct thing to do, that the kids who had the hardest time adjusting to this system were the American kids when they moved there. They were always sort of the outsiders for the longest periods of time, and they were often really the most bratty, you know, very, they were sort of seen as bullies. And I wondered what it is about Oh, and then when I moved here, I was really excited about the potential of moving to the United States. I had thought of the U.S. as being sort of this land of milk and honey, the land of television and Disneyland and sort of all of the things that kids thought of as being just ideal. And my actual experience of moving here was just absolute hell. Mm. And it was sort of such a shock because it seemed so primitive to me. And my expectation was that it was supposed to be the most, you know, forward-thinking place in the world. And so what was the difference between my expectation and reality? And one of the things I realized was, oh, my God, I'm moving to an entire country of brats. You know, it's sort of like that the experience we had had in international school of the Americans being the hardest to fit in with the group was also my experience of moving here, and that kids here seemed perfectly able, willing, and allowed to be totally disrespectful to each other and their elders in a way that would just never have even been considered elsewhere. And I just want some feedback from you, Sarah, on why do you think that might be?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that it is, I believe, the total responsibility of the adults to not allow a child to be disrespectful. Now, you've got the two-year-old, okay? The two-year-olds go through their thing. And you get through the two-year-old thing. And so by about 3 years old, a child should not be hitting or punching or kicking a parent. It should be stopped, and it should be encouraged to be loving and respectful. And if this is started early, it will be very natural. You don't even ignore it one time, at least to my idea. There used to be, I can't remember what psychologist said, ignore the negative behavior, it'll go away. Well, you know,
wasn't that Spock?
Yes. Well, was that Spock? It might have been.
I didn't find that true.
I found if you ignore the negative behavior and you don't stop it and you don't address it, it'll keep on. And so in my laboratory of hundreds of children, we do not allow even one time of disrespect or attitude, as they say, you know, the rolling of the eyes even.
Right.
Which they
right.
start doing when they get a little bit older. If I see that, I say, you know, when you roll your eyes like that, this is how it makes me feel. It makes me feel like you do not listen. You do not respect what I want to say to you. Don't do that. It makes me feel bad. It makes anybody else feel bad. So we address each and every incident to the best of our ability, of course, to require respect, and children will come up to that standard. And I think that the adults have really let the children down who do not address this. It has to be age appropriate, of course. But children should never call adults names, and you know, you address it when it happens the first time. That's my opinion.
You know, some of it might be cultural, and some of it might be the fact that America is a melting pot. But children, I mean, and we all know this, as we've been dealing with it, and we've been talking about it. Children are wonderful and beautiful and spiritual and open and adventuresome and easy to teach and all of those wonderful things. But there's another side to children.
Yes.
And we've been talking about it somewhat, about the, you know, the schoolyard bully. Children can be cruel beyond measure.
Mm-hmm.
Children can be almost animalistic in their cruelty. And this is why they need their parents, and they need competent teachers and elders to teach them not only the basics of language and knowledge, but also the basics of social behavior and how to be kind and loving, because I don't think that's naturally or necessarily natural. Children can gang up on a child.
Yes.
I've seen a bully rally a whole playground against one child.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think those are behaviors in children that we have to acknowledge. And like you said, Sarah, you know, you have to look them right in the eye and say,
yeah,
that's disrespectful. And I won't tolerate that because I don't deserve that. I'm here to help you, and I'm here to serve you, and
yeah,
I need your cooperation in this.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, I think that, you know, when I was in Israel in 1994, I witnessed two about 13-year-old Hasidic Jews throwing stones at an old woman that was trying,
oh,
to get through their neighborhood.
Oh.
And the old woman was, gee, she must have been 76, 77 years old. She was running, trying to keep from being stoned by two children.
Mm.
And you know, so we're talking about international culture. I will never forget that view as long as I live, because they took such glee. It's like, you know, the Midway is telling us, what is it of the animal in man that would cause them to assault this undefending being, this beautiful being of Jesus? What is it that would cause these people to taunt him and spit on him and treat him this way? It's the same thing. It's the animal in humanity that would cause them to do that and take and derive a certain amount of pleasure from that. And these two boys were getting delight from throwing stones at an old woman who was running, trying to get away from them. And I remember thinking, what would cause, because in my world, no 13-year-old would ever throw stones at an old woman. In my world, old people are to be respected and honored and loved and helped.
Yeah.
And in my world, that old woman is somebody's mother.
Mm.
And, you know, this is what I grew up, this is what my grandmother taught me, that everybody is somebody's beloved.
Yes.
And to treat them in that way. And so, you know, when I saw that, it was a total disconnect for me, and I realized that these children learned that hatred.
Yes.
Somebody taught them that. That's not, I don't believe that's normal for children to throw stones at an old woman, but, you know, how do you restrain that? That's got to be, I have to agree that, you know, I think it was Hillary Clinton that said it takes a village.
Yes.
And it takes every adult being on the same page that, you know, hatred is not a thing to teach children.
Well, it does seem that in this culture here, we do seem to promote the idea that we are somehow better than everybody else.
Well, I think it's, I think, you know what I think, though, Crystal? I think some of it is, you know, America's greatest virtue, I think, is, can also maybe be its greatest weakness, which is, you know, one of the, and this is kind of a sort of an off subject, but there's a concept called American exceptionalism, which is the idea that America is not like other nations. And, you know, and some of that's very beautiful. I mean, one of the ways in which we're not like other nations is we're not a nation based on ethnicity or bloodline, or, you know, we're a nation based on a political creed, which says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, you know, that kind of thing. But I think one of the things that, you know, America was a nation that was founded in violent revolution. That's what founded America, you know. And so, you know, and I think that America is also, one of the things I love about America, and one of the things I think Europeans don't understand about America, is that America is, in America, the individual is more important than the state. And those are all good things. The problem is that, you know, it's like anything. It can be taken to an extreme. People, I think in a lot of other countries, the order and stability are valued more than individual freedom. And I'm personally glad we live in a society where individual freedom is valued. I guess the question comes down to, you know, has this emphasis on, I won't say that it's an overemphasis, because I don't actually think of it, but I think maybe it's maybe the emphasis has become distorted in certain situations, maybe in child rearing or in certain parts of our culture. The emphasis on individualism or individual self-expression can
individual rights versus sort of the rights of the group. And I mean, one of the sort of my parenting Bible or a book that really influenced me a great deal when I had my first experience of step-parenting was a book called Redirecting Children's Misbehavior.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's excellent.
In that, they talk that there are two things that we need to teach our children. One of them is self-respect, and the other is respect for others, mm-hmm. and that it's not okay for either of those to be missing, that mm-hmm. that balance is absolutely necessary. And it seemed so simple to me, and the illustrations of how you teach self-respect and how you teach self-respect for others seemed very, very clear. And it, because the Urantia book says that one of the most important aspects of education has to be the perpetuation of the home.
Mm-hmm.
That respect, you know, teaching our children respect for themselves as well as respect for others really somehow has to be further up on the list of our sort of national priorities.
Well, and the child learns that self-respect in the home. If a child is respected in the home and is treated with love, everybody uses this word love, but is treated as an individual in their own right and as a part of the whole, that you're absolutely right that those two aspects, is respect for self and respect for others, are learned in the home. And that's probably one of the good things about, you know, a good daycare center, is that they can learn that in a good daycare center or a good preschool and a good school, because they work as as a group. And if you are violating a person in the group, then you're violating the group, and it has to be addressed. And,
you know, I think you bring up an important point, Sarah, and that is that a lot of times a good daycare or a good school is a child's salvation because they don't learn mm-hmm. those lessons in the home. We have another caller. Hold on. Hello, caller. You're on Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen. Hello? Hello?
We don't know who's on the air.
Yeah, it showed up as all ones again. So David pointed out to me that sometimes when they call through the system, that's the way that shows up. But
we can pursue what we've been talking about. But there's another aspect that I'd like to bring up,
sure,
having to do with the responsibility of the adults, and it has to do with loyalties. As we know, the Urantia book says that children respond, first of all, to the loyalties of their parents and adult associates.
Mm.
And I was always looking for what these loyalties were, and I came across a marvelous list that if we as adults and parents and teachers around children can keep these in mind, then our children will respond to these loyalties even more than precept or example.
Yes.
And so Jesus had a keen realization of the reality and sacredness of all human loyalties.
Mm.
And following that is the list. Number one, personal honor. So that's that self-respect.
Hey, Sarah, do you have a page reference for this?
I do. Let's see. I believe it's...
I can look it up.
Yeah, paper 160. Well, not a page number, but I just go by the papers. 160,
okay.
Section 4, paragraph 4.
Okay.
Or it might also be... I have two down here. It might also be paper 84, section 7, paragraph 30. I'm not sure which one of those it is. It probably is
okay.
The 84.
Okay.
So the first is personal honor, that and these are what the parents must realize, be conscious of, is their loyalties. The second is family love. So there you get that obligation to the whole, to the group. The third sacred loyalty is religious obligation, and that can be interpreted in many, many different ways. And the fourth sacred human loyalty is social duty. So that's, you know, going out and serving others. And the fifth, which is really interesting, sacred human loyalty is economic necessity.
Work
now, you know, I'm seeing another page here that I've got. I'm sorry for the confusion. 196, paper 196.
Yes, that's where I am. I looked it up,
That's the list. I'm sorry. That is the list.
And just allow me here, if you would, to read this quote for the folks, because this is from Part 4, The Life and Teachings of Jesus, paper 196, The Faith of Jesus, as we know, is a beautiful. We actually had Diane on to do a whole show on the faith of Jesus. But just reading from the middle of the paragraph, it says, the Son of Man, meaning Jesus, obviously, the Son of Man was a splendidly unified human personality. He was a perfectly endowed divine being. He was also magnificently coordinated as a combined human and divine being functioning on earth as a single personality. Always did the Master coordinate the faith of the soul with the wisdom appraisals of seasoned experience. Personal faith, spiritual hope, and moral devotion were always correlated in a matchless religious unity of harmonious association with the keen realization of the reality and sacredness of all human loyalties. And then the list Sarah read, personal honor, family love, religious obligation, social duty, and economic necessity. I'm so glad you brought that up, Sarah, because I love lists like that. And, you know, I have pondered that quote about children learn more from our loyalties, even more than precept or example, right, is what it says. And I've pondered that myself and wondered about the human loyalties. I'm surprised that I didn't ever look up human loyalties, because here's this beautiful list right here. Personal honor, family love, religious obligation, social duty, and economic necessity.
Well, and I think what's going on here, if you allow me to get another little soapbox here, I think what's going on here is you know, what is the parent's model? You know, as you said, Sarah, if a child is treated with respect, they don't. I think what happens is that with some adults, unfortunately, is they get into this sort of old school mentality: "Is you better respect me? I'm your mom. You can't demand respect. You've got to model respect." And I think that that's really, you know, it's a key thing. I mean, it's like when I was growing up, you know, I was told not to swear and cuss at my sister, but yet my father could verbally abuse me and swear at me anytime he wanted.
Ooh.
You know, it was do as I say, not as I do, you know, and I hope that we were evolving out of that pretty quickly. But, you know, I think one of the things I want to also bring up, and something that's really, that you've said several times in the conversation, Sarah, and I think it's really important. You talk to children about feelings. I think this is so important because, let me tell you what really frustrates me is, and I'm sure you're quite aware of this, you know, with your background in child development, a lot of times when a child hurts somebody else, another child, you know, a lot of times parents will say, I'm sorry, you know, they try to force the kid. The kid doesn't even know what it means yet, you know, doesn't know what an apology means. What is the purpose of saying I'm sorry? The purpose of saying I'm sorry is to communicate that you really are sorry. So how do you produce feelings of remorse in a child? And I think the way you do that is by teaching empathy. And the way you teach empathy is by saying to the child, you know, how do you think it made Johnny feel when you hit Johnny? You know, you teach. That's what the golden rule is about. You teach the golden rule by talking about feelings, and then you tell them, you know, when we feel bad about, you know, do you see that Johnny could have felt bad when you hit him? Do you don't want to make people feel bad, do you? You know, so you guide them through this process, and then when the child you get to the point where the child realizes, yeah, they really feel bad, then you can say, you know what we say to people when we feel bad about something we've done? You know, we can say, I'm sorry. The same thing goes, I think, for you know, when I was a child, my mom drilled manners into me, and don't get me wrong, I mean, I have no problem with saying please and thank you and all that, but the thing is, it was almost like I felt like I was made to feel like almost like I had to respond like a robot, you know, where it wasn't really, I mean, again, let's take the word thank you as a great example. Why do we say thank you? Because we're grateful. How do we cultivate gratitude in a child? Not by saying, you better appreciate what I do for you, you know, and that kind of stuff, but I think by looking for teachable moments. I mean, one example would be, you know, let's say the child received a gift that they really were excited about, you know, and they're jumping around for joy, and they're all excited, you know, you can sit down with them and say, hey, you know what? You're really excited about what, you know, Uncle Tom just got you or whatever, aren't you? And you're like, yeah. And you can talk to them about the gift. Talk to them for a few minutes about it. You know, just talk, why are they excited? What do they like about it? And then you can say, you know what we say to people when we're excited about something and that they did for us, you know? There's a special word for that. It's called thank you. So, I mean, are we on the same page here?
Andre, absolutely. You are so right on. It's partially also helping the child to develop a habit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even before they really appreciation of saying thank you and please. I've seen so many parents do this. You know, they'll say it for their child, modeling for the child, and then they will ask that their child say it, please and thank you, especially those two. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. It's a habit, and then eventually the child will come to feel it. With the I'm sorry, it's a little more complex. The way that I like to do it is if one child hurts the feelings of or hits another child, you have both children standing in front of you, and the child that got hurt might be crying. And you give that a moment while the child that did the hurting looks at the child who is crying. And in that teachable moment, you can allow them to see or to feel what that is like when the child is crying. And then you can go on with your words. And more often than not, the child that did the hurting feels just about as bad as the child that got hurt. Sometimes they both end up crying.
Yes.
And to acknowledge that, I can see that you really feel bad about hurting his feelings.
Yes.
And then they get into that feeling space. And, it does seem to be something that children need to do, though, is to say, I'm sorry. And that should be encouraged because it's kind of closure. You know, they may
for
not
both,
feel sorry.
For both parties, it's closure.
It is.
It's
for both parties, it's closure. And often that child who had wrong done to him or her will say, that's okay. And then they walk on their own way.
Mm-hmm. But they get over it.
They get over it. They get over it. You know, the adults might.
Yeah, adults don't. I'm sure you've seen that, Sarah, that adults don't get over it. But my grandmother used to tell me a story about that. You know, she lived in the same house for 50 years, and she said one day the kids were all out playing in the street, and a big fight broke out. And she said the adults, the parents came out and got involved in this big fight, and before you know it was a big brawl in the street, and all the adults were fighting with each other. And the next thing, you know, here comes the paddy wagon and takes all the adults off. And my grandmother was talking to one of the men involved in this brawl, and she said, what was your opinion of what happened there the other day? He said, well, one thing I know, he said, we were all sitting in the back of the paddy wagon, and as we looked out the back of the window, all the kids were playing in the street again.
that's a great example. Children forgive very easily. And they should be encouraged to forgive, and that word should be used. I just had a situation just recently where fifth graders, these are 11-year-old girls, one told the other one a secret, and it was a secret that should not have been shared, but the girls shared it, and word went around, and many, many hurt feelings. And then the parents got involved, and one mother said, that was an unforgivable thing for my daughter to have done, is to have shared that secret.
Ooh.
And I thought, no. Forgiveness is so important.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Did you get a chance to say anything to that mother about that?
Oh, I did, absolutely.
Good, I'm glad.
Yeah, I do a lot of email with parents, and I emphasize that. I said, because children forgive easily, the one whose secret was shared should be encouraged to forgive, not forced, encouraged to forgive.
Yeah.
And I think, it all kind of...
Especially if the forgiver, if the person who did the hurt, you know, is truly is remorseful. But the other thing I wanted to also say is, you talked about please and thank you. I got to tell you, though, I have some issues with some of this, though, because what concerns me is, it's not that I think there's anything wrong with telling teaching kids to say please and thank you. Although, as I said before, I wish that that's done. I would like to see that done in terms of teachable moments, in terms of when a child is really in a place where they can really connect it with some real reality and not just saying a bunch of rote words. But having said that, okay, I have to tell you, I'm not a big fan of Miss Manners and Emily Post and all these etiquette. And the reason is because I think there's a difference between politeness and kindness.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between my concern about the emphasis on manners and etiquette in a lot of cases is that it becomes it's about what appearance becomes more important than reality. You know, it's almost like, well, I'll give you an example. This is back when I was 23. I got I was involved in a protest, and I actually went to jail for it. It was a political protest. I won't get into it, but I was involved in a protest, and I went to jail for it. And I was very proud of myself. And my aunt gave me a sweatshirt that said "I spent time in the slammer," which I thought was just a great shirt.
Oh yeah,
it was just so much fun to have. You know, and I got it for Christmas, and I was so excited. I was like in my 20s when I got it. Okay, and my mom still treated me like I was 4 years old. And she's like, "Did you say thank you?"
Yeah.
And you know, I don't remember, to be honest with you, if I said thank you. I was so excited that I did, but it was obvious to my aunt that I was grateful. You know, and see, to me, and the same thing goes with the word please. You know, I don't expect my good friends to say please to me every time they want something. A lot of it has to do with the tone of voice that you use. A lot of it has to do, and that's why I think really, again, the issue is how are you treating the children? What are you teaching them by what you're modeling? Because to me, it's not about saying the right words. It's about being the right kind of person.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and you know what really that is about right motivations. And I think the Urantia book, when we think about it, The recurring theme throughout the whole book is right motivations, is coming to God because you know that God's way, you know, is the right way. And that's the only thing that you can do that is really of value to God, is that you want to do His will because you know it's the right will and because you crave to do right. And to teach children right motivations, and not just to try to force them or coerce them to do something because, you know, out of fear of you, that's the absolute wrong motivation.
And what it is to me, and I'm sorry, I want you to jump in here a minute, but what it is to me is it's about getting it right on the inside, not just on the outside.
Right, exactly.
Well, I really acknowledge what you're saying, is that you do have to feel what you're saying when you say thank you, please, and sorry. And that comes eventually. However, I still think that the adult, the parent, actually almost requiring, you don't have to do so in anger, but requiring children to develop habit-forming reactions. It's kind of like the oil of society. It's kind of like very, very young, you're teaching them that most people appreciate saying please and thank you. And you don't have to use a lot of words. You do model it yourself. But, you know, the frequent repetitions and persistent repetitions, the number of repetitions is important. And eventually a child will do it when they're not even thinking about it because they have been trained. I think there's something to be said for training, and we probably have lost touch with that a little bit. Now, if you are using anger or emotion when you're trying to train a child, the child can move away from it. I often tell parents, when you're angry, the child is not listening to what you're angry about. The child is concerned about your anger. And so you're missing the opportunity to teach your child if you are angry or overly emotional. So if you're overly emotional about, you know, manners, and you make manners a big thing at the dinner table, then and there's a lot of emotion there, the child's going to resent that, and it probably will have a negative effect.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, don't
you know,
Sarah?
Go
ahead.
I know that you have a. You have a son, you've raised a son, and you've seen children and parents in probably every possible stressful situation too. What can a parent do when a child, and as you know, children can push their parent to the absolute edge of utter dismay and frustration to where these
needs. You know, any parent can I think, exhibit the emotions of a two-year-old when they've been frazzled and pushed to the very edge and then over the cliff. And children can do that better to a parent than anybody else can do it. You know, you can go out into the world and face the world and be so strong and so confident and so tactful, and then come back and your child can just turn you into a total puddle. Am I the only one that's experienced this, or
are you kidding? I see that often. Parents are tired when they pick the children up, and the children are tired, and you know they start whining. Maybe they haven't been whining for 3 or 4 hours, but the parent walks in and they start whining, and they want this and this and this. And I try to help the parent be aware. Number one, you're all tired. And number two, just because a child wants something, they want to go to McDonald's, for example, you know, for dinner, doesn't mean that you have to give it to them.
Right.
And children are superlative in their manipulations. And, you know, you've got the cute little girls who will break down and cry, and they'll get what they want. You've got, you know, other children that will get angry or threaten or just sit down on the floor and not move. And parents have to really be wise at this point and evaluate if they are being manipulated. And, you know, because children are out for their own pleasure.
That's
we all
right.
know that. Child wants what they want, and they want it now.
Yes.
And so the parent has to kind of develop some skills of asking questions. And also, like Andre said a little while ago, is, you know, acknowledging feelings. I see that you're really hungry and that you want a McDonald's burger, but, you know, we're going to go home and we're gonna have something else. So you don't have to cave in. Once in a while.
I want to reiterate this validating feelings thing, because I think it's one thing that really bothers me is, and I don't mean to be so hard on parents, but what bothers me is, oh, it really drives me. I just read an extreme example of this. You know, you're in Northern California, Sarah, where there's probably, I don't know where you, maybe close to, I don't know if it's close
San
to
San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, well, but you know, there's a bit of, there's a Samoan community, a pretty large Samoan community. And there, I was reading about Samoan culture because I would love to meet a Samoan woman, but that's a whole other story. I was reading about it because, and one of the things that really concerns me is, you know what they do to kids, a lot of the Samoan cultures? They slap children for crying, which really, really bothered me. And it really bothers me when I hear about parents who punish their kids for crying or whatever. And that's an extreme example. Okay, in fact, what they do is they when a child cries, they slap the child and they say "uma," which means "all done," you know, "it's over."
Mm-hmm.
And they do not let the child have any negative feelings, and they do it until the child stops crying, which I think is just really horrendous. Okay, but one thing that really bothers me is the way a lot of adults react to tantrums, or if you want to call it tantrums.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when children whine or cry, that's just the way they express their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that we need. You know, a kid doesn't have to be punished or shamed for their feelings. And I think sometimes, you know, I'm not a parent, and I don't want to be hard on parents, but I think one of the worst things sometimes parents will do is yell when a child's having a tantrum. That's not going to calm the kid down. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of times, sometimes a child just wants their feelings validated. Maybe they need to be picked up. You don't have to cave in. I agree with you. You don't have to cave in and give the child everything they want if it's not something that's good for the child. You don't give the kids 16 candy bars just because they want them. Okay, having said that, but I do think you can validate, you can set limits, but also acknowledge, you know, that the child is feeling a certain way.
Yes. I think once the child's feelings are acknowledged, whether they're tired or hungry or angry, that in itself is almost magical.
Yeah,
it
I agree
opens with you. It opens up that respect that we're talking about, and the child knows that you're clued into them. Now, obviously, it takes a fairly mature adult to be with children. Otherwise, if you're on the child's level, which, you know, we all are at certain times because we get tired, and there's that child inside of us too, which is tired and angry sometimes. But I think if we keep ourselves grounded in God, and we have a daily practice of some sort where we are looking beyond ourselves or in ourselves for strength and awareness and consciousness. And if we do this as parents or teachers, any adults working with children, any adults anywhere actually, then we will be receiving the help of the universe, because all of us also have these circuits going through us. We have access to the spirit of truth, to our thought adjuster, the light of God within us, to the seven adjutant spirits, and to the Holy Spirit, which is connected, of course, directly with the cosmic mind. And so if you just spend 5 minutes, you know, in quiet of some sort, just tuning in, or whatever you do, people might have different ways. And then if you can set some time as a family to experience a few minutes of quiet as a family. Deepak Chopra talks, he's got a great book, Seven Principles of Spiritual Parenting. Mm. And in that book, he lists some things that parents can do to help their children stay centered, especially in the world today. And one of them is just learning the practice of meditation. And it can be for 1 minute. You know, maybe we'd like to meditate for an hour, but maybe the child can meditate for 1 minute. And so I think these practices help center us as adults, as teachers, as parents, so that our emotions aren't so raw, that we have a place to go back to when we're tired. We can take the deep breath and let it out. And when I teach children yoga, I share with them how to do this skill. Take a deep breath when you feel angry. Take a deep breath when you feel like you're going to cry. Take a deep breath when you feel like somebody's done something wrong with you. And then I show them how to take a deep breath, and they take the deep breath. And they take the deep breath and they let it out. And I say, now, how do you feel now? And invariably, they feel better. So I think that there are skills that we can develop ourselves, number one, and teach our children, number two, so that we don't get into this horrible emotional soup that, you know, is so destructive.
Right, and that children can get you into so easily.
Yeah.
I have to agree with you that, you know, I learned early on as a young mom, I was 19 when I had my first baby, and I learned that my baby was smarter than me. And I figured out that I have some experience over her, but she's brighter than me. And really, and I'm, to me, as I read the Urantia book, and it tells us that each generation is better and brighter, I affirmed that. I could affirm that because I said, yes, that's true, you know. My children had me figured out early on, and they are master manipulators. And, you know, their techniques at manipulation can get better as they get older. And, of course, when they become teenagers, watch out. And you really, as a parent, you know, I think a lot of times people who haven't parented tend to think that the answers are really easy, but they're not. Because when you add this all-encompassing love that you feel for this child into the mix, all bets are off in a way. I mean, you are so emotionally involved with them, and you love them so much, and you want so much for them. And really, the only thing that I think can teach that child how you feel about them is to experience parenthood themselves. And in my experience with both of my older children, now that they have become parents, all of a sudden, I am much easier to understand than I was when I was just their parent. You know, it's like, who was it? Mark Twain said, I moved away from home for 3 years when I graduated, and I came back, and my parents had gotten so wise. You know, and it is like that. Part of it is, you know, growing up, and my daughter will tell me, you know, she's often told me, Mom, I was your practice kid. She was my first, you know. She'll say, I was your practice kid. You made all your mistakes on me. And now Mei Li is the beneficiary of that.
Yes.
And I think that's true. You know, some things you just can't master until you experience them. And you have to make your mistakes as a parent, but I think that if you're honest with your children, if you're emotionally honest with your
mm-hmm.
children,
mm-hmm.
and you tell them, you know what, honey, I'm just tired and I'm sorry. I just need a break. They honor that.
Yeah, and I can tell you, when we talked about this before on the show, Paula, I can honestly tell you that there's nothing more powerful, I think, than a sincere apology from a parent
mm-hmm.
to a child. I never heard it from my dad. I heard it from my mom a couple times, but it would have done so much more to heal our relationship if I had heard that more often.
Well, it's emotional honesty, and children need to know that it's okay to be frazzled sometimes, and sometimes it's okay to be angry, that these are all human feelings. We certainly
mm-hmm.
need to master these things, but we shouldn't stifle them necessarily either. I mean, you know, we're all living together, and, you know, the Urantia book says that it's in the family that we learn these most important lessons of altruism. And, you know, there's a great list there of the things you learn in family life. Maybe I'll look it up for us. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think that it's a reality workshop kind of thing, and there is no perfect family life, just like there is no perfect person or no perfect parent, no perfect child. And but if you're emotionally honest with those people that you have to live with, and you're willing to put yourself out there and say, you know, I shouldn't have done that, and I'm sorry. Or,
yeah, Baba,
Go ahead. Is
well,
this
I was
Crystal?
It's Crystal. I'd like to respond to something that Andre said a few minutes ago, which is that, you know, it just seems wrong, like when a kid is having a temper tantrum or when they're really angry or they are expressing negative emotions, to just sort of cut them off or make them feel that that's bad. And I think that there are ways to do that, that teach kids self-control without diminishing their feelings or making them feel bad about those feelings, but also not allowing them to manipulate the rest of the group with their tantrum. And I think that those are things that are easily really able to be taught in courses like Love and Logic and some of the other parenting approaches that are out there about how you let your child have the emotion that they're having and allow them to experience that for as long as they need to experience it, just not in the presence of everyone else in the room. You know, where, in other words, you're not disciplining them in a negative way for having lost their self-control or having a tantrum, but acknowledge that they're having that tantrum in front of the rest of the family or in front of the whole group is really impinging on sort of the right of peace in the household. So they need to go have that temper tantrum in
mm-hmm.
the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And they can scream as loud as they want in the bathroom, and they can do, you know, they can express themselves however they need to do, for however long they need to do, but they can't really come out of the bathroom or come out of their bedroom until they're ready to be socially responsible.
And,
okay,
you know, Christy, I have heard that that's a technique for parents, too, who are at the end of their rope with a crying baby who will not be comforted, to just leave the baby for a minute and go somewhere to another room and calm down.
Mm-hmm.
Take, like Sarah said, deep breaths before you take it out on the child. And,
yeah. Well, absolutely. Crystal, let me just, I want to just respond to what you said, though, Crystal, because I think the problem, though, with a lot of parents, and again, I hate to bash parents on this show, it's just that I've seen this. I find with a lot of parents that they won't comfort a child when I think when a child is having a temper tantrum, having negative feelings, I think they do need to be soothed and comforted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with a lot of parents, they don't do that. They just react to the tantrum. They say, "Stop crying" or "Stop having the tantrum." And the other thing is, I think it's really important. If the child is open to being comforted, I think it's important that the parent sit down with the child and bond with that. You know, I don't know how wise it is to. I mean, if the child refuses to be comforted, then yes, I would agree with you that you need to leave the child
alone. I just really disagree with you on that. I mean, I'm sorry, but I just really do disagree with you, because my experience about that is that when, I mean, okay, let's say a child has been injured or a child has been attacked by someone, you know, by another kid, or they're hurt or their feelings are hurt or something has damaged them. They need comfort. But throwing a temper tantrum is really rarely about that. Throwing a temper tantrum is usually about getting what they want. It's that manipulative thing that kids do that's very different from just expressing frustration or about expressing pain. And that allowing that to be the time when they get rewarded, i.e. comforted, is not an appropriate, it's not setting that kid up for a successful life experience.
Well, let's ask the expert here. Sarah, what, you know, in your experience, what do you think about this?
Well, I agree that you cannot let a child who is going through an emotional state upset the whole group. So the child, you know, in a group situation, family or, you know, school or daycare, the child needs to be removed. And usually it's only younger children that are having the tantrums, you know, like 2, 3, 4. By 5 years old, they should have hopefully grown beyond having a tantrum and can express that they want something. I really, really want it. Please give it to me. You know, they can use words instead of fall down on the I don't think you usually see a 5 or 6 year old fall down on a grocery store floor and cry.
Right.
I have seen parents walk away from a child who is on the grocery store floor crying, and as soon as the child sees the parent walking away, the child gets up and runs towards the parent. And you know, that's one way of doing that. You know, I don't know. I don't have all of the answers to that. I think that there could be times in a moment of a tantrum when they wanted something really, really bad and they didn't get it, that you could hold them and say, you know, I know you really want that, but you can't have it, and I'm really sorry. You know, sometimes even as adults, we want something really, really bad, and we throw our own little internal tantrums, and sometimes it's really nice, you know, if our friend or spouse comes and says, you know, I'm really sorry that we couldn't make that happen. And it feels really good to be acknowledged like that. I agree that on the whole, a tantrum is manipulative. And the children who have tantrums that I've observed are the children that have gotten away with it. They have a tantrum,
right.
They get what they want.
Right. Mm. And that's what I was talking about, really,
yeah.
Is that where you're dealing with maybe an 8 or 9 or 10 year old kid.
Oh, I wasn't talking about
still
that.
Utilizing,
I wasn't thinking it was that old.
Still utilizing that as a way of getting attention because it's the only way they have successfully received comfort,
yes,
in the past. And
yes,
that is really setting that kid up for,
you know. And I,
you
think
know,
you bring up such an important point, and this is something that I wanted to point out when we were talking about bullying recently. I have noticed, and Sarah, you may have noticed this too, I have noticed that oftentimes bullies are children who are neglected,
yes,
and they're not getting their needs met, and the only way they can get attention is by being a bully. And I identified this same pattern in the two boys that perpetuated the Columbine massacre. Is that and I think that, you know, as unfortunate, as horrible as that was, and everybody wants to demonize these two young men, I think that there's a pattern there that needs to be looked at that societally. And what it is it's children that are being ignored, and nobody cares what they're doing. Nobody cares what's happening to them. These two boys had sawed-off shotguns sitting in their bedroom, and nobody noticed. They were building bombs in their garage, and nobody seemed to notice. They were not only ignored and bullied at school, they were ignored at home.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, lest we think that the things that we do to our children have no repercussions, and I think parents make this mistake. that they think, oh, they're just little, they'll forget about it. Oh, they don't care what I'm doing. They don't care. You know, that is the greatest tragedy, to think that what you do to your children doesn't matter and has no ramifications in the real world, because it does. And I think it's important to meet your children's needs, because in my experience, children will get your attention. If they have to get it a good way or a bad way, they'll get it, because they need it. They need you to pay attention to them.
You're so right on, Paula.
And
we have a caller.
Can you hold that thought for a minute,
sure,
Christy?
Sure.
We have a caller. Hold on. I think it's Quester. It's Dave from Canada. Hold on. Dave, is that you?
It certainly is. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yeah.
Hi there.
Hi, Dave.
Wanted to contribute a little story that I find amusing on the subject of tantrums,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps, Paula, the way children are able to get parents going. So here it comes. This dates back quite a number of years, when I was sort of courting my wife, if I can put it in those terms. And we had just pulled into a parking lot of a department store. And moments after, the car to my left had pulled in. And we both remarked upon the fact that there were two kids in the back seat, and they were just crying in absolute distress as their parents were getting out of the car. And you couldn't help but hear what they were concerned about. They were being left in the car while the parents went in shopping. I should hasten to add again, this was a number of years ago, before leaving your kids in the car was a topic of concern, and people seemed to do it for whatever reason. In any case, these kids were just crying. They were in absolute distress, and I was really worried about them. But I watched as their parents disappeared from view, and when all of a sudden the older kid said to the younger, "Well, I guess that didn't work. We won't be going with them this time."
Oh, my.
So I couldn't help myself. I tapped on the window, and I said, "Hey, you guys, you really spoiled it for the rest of your generation, because now I know that I can't always believe it when you put up a fuss." But I just had to share that.
Good.
Well, they're very good actors.
No kidding. And I would never have realized had I not overheard their final remarks.
Yes. How conscious they were about it. That's what's scary.
How deliberate.
Absolutely.
Deliberate.
So
yes.
They spoiled it for my kids. And I get no end of joy in telling them whenever they put up such a show that they have these two kids from the 20, 30 odd years ago to blame for the fact that they couldn't pull the wool over my eyes.
Oh, that's great, Dave. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Cheers, all.
Cheers.
Thanks.
Another thing that I find works, at least when a tantrum, so to speak, happens in a group situation, is to point out to the child that all of these kids are looking at you, and the child is so much into himself or herself involved in this tantrum or this emotion that they're out of control, and then all of a sudden the child will look up and look around, and indeed all of the children are looking at the child because they do not understand. And I tell the child that they don't understand what has happened that, you know, is creating such a feeling in you. And once the child, now this is a child, you know, probably has to be at, you know, around 5 years old at least, is aware that others are watching this negative display, that often in itself is enough to help the child get themselves back under control. And that could happen in the grocery store, too.
You know, they say that sometimes the way to calm a baby, and I don't know, you may have heard this study, Sarah, is that to have them, when they hear another child crying, that calms them down. That's an interesting thing that I've heard. I don't know if there's any truth to it, but. Well, we're down to our last 4 minutes. And isn't it amazing, Sarah, how fast the time goes by?
It is. And you know, I'm going to go in a few minutes and be with my 90-year-old mother. I
wow.
hope to take her to the ocean today. But I bring this up because often our elders enter into a realm which is similar to childhood. Now, my mother's, you know, pretty much right there. She doesn't have Alzheimer's and very little dementia. But the emotions seem to be heading back, you know, into the childhood realm. And mm. I find that my 90-year-old mother is manipulative enough to engage emotion in me as she tries to get something. And so I just want to point out that, you know, for those of us that are dealing with some of our elders who might be quite practiced in getting us emotional, that we can use some of the same direct expressions. You know, when you do this, I feel, you know, and you need to let them know. Children, it works quite well. And let them know that, you know, it's creating a problem for you. Anyway, I'm
right,
getting myself
and
ready.
Maybe like Dave from Canada, it's not working.
Yeah, right.
It's not going to work.
Yeah, it's not going to work, right. Let's try another way.
Yeah, Sarah, you know, it was so great having you on the show today. Thank you so much for coming.
Well, and thank you so much for allowing me to express myself, Andre and Paula. It's really been a good experience.
Thanks, everyone on the board. Love you guys.
Thank you.
Next week. Bye, Andre.
Goodbye, Paula.